Hopefully we can do two things tonight. Number one, cover Genesis 30, 25 through 43. And since we're in a section where we're seeing enormous consequences of actions, of deception and what have you, I would like to take a little time at the end, if we have time, to look at the doctrine of consequences from the standpoint of the book of Proverbs, if we have time to do so. Now, however, we're ready to look at chapter 30, verses 25 through 42, and it will be captioned, "The Blessing of Material Prosperity." The focal point, again, is Jacob in relationship to Laban, and the section runs from chapter 30, verse 25. Through verse 43. And we have several points of introduction to make coming into the chapter. First, the theme: material blessing. And while it is true there are many, many kinds of blessings that God gives, in the Old Testament, material blessing is one of them. Now, I think here is where we have an enormous contrast between the Old Testament and the church age. In the church age, there is no promise of material blessing. In the Old Testament, part of God's blessing was material. Things such as, if you obey me, you'll get your rainfall. If you obey me, I'll bless your crops. If you obey me, I'll increase your cattle, which would be tantamount to saying I'll increase your bank account. And over in the Old Testament, you have a promise of physical material blessings. May I repeat, in the church age, we have no parallel. You cannot go to the letter written to the church at Ephesus or Colossae or Philippians and find any direct promise that if you obey and walk with me, I will bless you materially. And the reason that is important to grasp is because we had a little series a while back we called the Prosperity Gospel. And the Prosperity Gospel is a very popular thing today that says if you will obey God, if you will do certain things, then you will get certain material blessings. And Joshua is used, passages such as this are used, because you come to verse 43 of chapter 30, which says, "The man became exceedingly prosperous." And if you, like Jacob, will obey God, you too can become materially prosperous and expect it. And that is not true. That is a perversion of the gospel. The land was a physical thing. It was an earthly thing. And many of the blessings of Israel were material blessings that are not duplicated, that are not repeatable, and that are not applicable in the church age today. But the theme here is material blessing. Sub-points under that theme. First of all, we know that Jacob, because of his presence, had brought enormous material prosperity to Laban. If you look over at chapter 30, verse 29, and Laban acknowledges this, he said to him, "You yourself know I have served you and how your cattle have fared with me." This is Jacob speaking to Laban. "For you had little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turn. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?" So Jacob had been instrumental in bringing enormous blessing to him. The closing statement focuses on material prosperity. Closing statement, chapter 30, verse 43, which we just read. That's the theme. Now, it's also true that material blessing, and by the way, that doesn't mean that if in the church age you happen to get material blessing that God didn't give it. What it does mean is you can't say to God, "If I obey like your word says, you've got to increase my bank account." In the Old Testament, that was promised by God. If you go in certain direction, I will materially bless you, but not true in the New. Now, whenever we look at material blessing, it can do one of two things. to men. In fact, material blessing inevitably does one of these two things. Number one, it may be viewed as a trust from God and used for good. Material blessing and can be viewed as a trust from God, and as a result of seeing that, put to good use. However, there's another viewpoint that men commonly take on material blessing, and that is this. Others see it as the result of personal accomplishment and use it as a means to establish personal power. So, material blessing may be viewed as a trust from God and put to good use, or two, it may be viewed purely as personal accomplishment or personal achievement and thus used to establish power. A power base. All right, a third point of introduction is this. The story of his personal prosperity is complementary to God's prosperity of his family that we studied in our last session. So this is complementary section. Complementary meaning it fills out, complements, goes with it. And basically what it complements is, first, we had growth of family, and we spent all of our last time on that in the preceding verses, and now it is growth of wealth. God blesses his family, now God blesses his work. God blessed him with children, God now blesses him with cattle and wealth. Fourth point of introduction. The family and the wealth section stands at the center of Jacob's history. Here's what we mean. Up until chapter 29 and verse 25, where you begin with the growth of his children, we have had his journey from home. For fear of Esau, he leaves, then experiences prosperity, both in family and possessions, in chapter 29, 25 through verse 43. And then you find immediately following that, we go back to the reverse and we have the journey back home. So Moses has organization and structure in Genesis, and it's sort of like you're going uphill, leaving home, you reach the apex of the hill, God blesses him with sons, God blesses him with cattle, God blesses him family-wise, God blesses him materially, and then, as soon as that is achieved and done, God says, now, it's time to go back home, back to the land. So, the prosperity of Jacob in family and material wealth is the centerpiece of the whole story of the life of Jacob. The theme of deception continues. The theme of deception continues. Let's put it down this way. In chapter 27, chapter 29, and chapter 30 are filled with deception. In chapter 27, Jacob deceived Isaac, his father. And in chapter 29, Laban deceived Jacob. in order to gain 14 years of his service. In chapter 30, we have Jacob not so much deceived, but outwitted Laban in order to gain the larger share of the herd. Here's the way one person put it, the pattern. In Genesis 27, Jacob is a deceiver. In Genesis 29, Laban is the deceiver of a deceiver. And in chapter 30, Jacob is the deceiver of a deceiver of a deceiver. See that pattern? Let me run through once again. Chapter 27, Jacob is a deceiver. Chapter 29, Laban is the deceiver of the deceiver. And now as we come to chapter 30 tonight, we will find that Laban, or Jacob, rather, is the deceiver of a deceiver of a deceiver. And so the soap opera continues. Genesis right now is just about like the soaps. Can't you imagine some of the themes you could build off these? They ought to try doing that. Get out and do whatever the soaps are. Okay, a sixth point of introduction. And that is the prosperity that he experiences must be seen as linked to promise. Prosperity is linked to promise. And we can explain that with 3 points. First, Jacob's expectation. And we'll go to a verse for that. When he came down to the house of Laban, what did he expect? Then we have an emphasis on Jacob's abundance. And again, in a moment, we'll associate this with a verse. And third, you have Jacob's interpretation of that abundance. What it meant and where it came from. Let's go and associate a passage with each one of these. First, Jacob's expectation. And that goes back to chapter 28, verse 20. 28:20. The Lord has appeared to him at Bethel, and he names the place Bethel. This is the turning point, as you know, in the life of Jacob. And when you come to verse 20, it says, Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear. So there is very clearly what Jacob expected and anticipated. He expected food, and he expected clothes. And really, his expectations, according to this verse, were no bigger than that. You come, however, over to chapter 30 and verse 43, and you have an emphasis that God did much, much more than bless him with abundance, than give him food and clothing. Because verse 43 reads, so the man became exceedingly prosperous, had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. So you have an example of, he said, I want food and clothes, and God did far abundantly above all he ever expected. Now there is a link, and the link is between his expectation and his abundance was a provision of God. And you have that over at chapter 31 and verse 9. 31:9. Which reads, thus, and this is Jacob speaking to his wives, thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. Came about the time when the flock were mating and so forth and so forth. But notice the link is ultimately God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. All right, seventh and final point of introduction. chapter 30, beginning at verse 25 down through verse 43, comes in two parts. Part one is dialogue. So 30, 25 through 34 is entirely dialogue. And the dialogue is very, very simple. It's Jacob Laban, Jacob Laban, Jacob Laban. And we'll see that in a minute. It's all dialogue. With verse 35 through 43, the dialogue stops. And from there on, it is entirely narrative, a narrative report. And I'll put parenthetically under the word narrative. It is a narrative report of the outcome of the arrangement made in the dialogue. The nature of the dialogue is Jacob and Laban talking back and forth, coming to agreement on what each will do, and then in verse 35, the dialogue stops, and we see how all of this turned out. Okay, let's start then with the two parts. Part one is going to be the formulation of an agreement. Part one will be the formulation of an agreement. Part two will be the outcome of the agreement. But first, the setting that gives us how this got all formulated in verses 25 through 34. And the first thing to note is the pattern. And the pattern is Jacob, Laban. Jacob speaks, Laban speaks, and that is repeated three times. And let's read this through to catch the thrust of it, beginning at verse 35. Notice it's dialogue, it's back and forth. It came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart. For you yourself know my servant which I have rendered to you." And that's the first statement of Jacob. Laban said to him, "If it now pleases you, stay with me. I have divined that the Lord has blessed me on your account." And he continued, "Name me your wages and I will give it." Now we're back to Jacob again. But he, Jacob, said to him, "You yourself know how I have served you and how your cattle have feared with me. For you had little before I came, and it is increased to a multitude, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I turn. But now, when shall I provide for my own household also?" Laban, back to Laban now, and he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You do not give me anything. If you will do this one thing for me, I will again pasture and keep your flock." And he continues down through verse 32 and verse 33, and Laban responds. So it's a triple Jacob-Laban pattern. So here are the three cycles. We begin simply in the outline, the three cycles. Number one, it begins with Jacob's request. Now the emphasis in verse 25 and 26 is fulfilled obligation. The stress that Jacob makes is fulfilled obligation. I have done what I was expected to do. And that's the first thing that he calls to Laban's mind, that he has fulfilled his obligation. As we will find out very much so in this passage, I don't know who the biggest rascal is, Laban or Jacob. I think if you view it from the standpoint of this chapter, Jacob is probably one of the biggest rascals you can imagine anywhere in Scripture. But notice that emphasis. If you come down to verse 26, it says, "Give me all eyes and my children for whom I have served you, and let me depart. For you yourself know my service, which I rendered." And the word rendered is a good translation, but notice you have the number one by it, and you go out to the margin, and it says literally served. And that's true. So then he is saying, my service. My service would be what was expected. My service, I have served. So that my service emphasizes obligation, the thing you expected me to do, the package of service you expected me to fulfill, and I serve fulfillment. And unfortunately, I think that link between the obligation and the fulfillment is missed because our New American is putting the word rendered there to him. But my service is what you expected of me, and I have done what you expected. Emphasis is on completed obligation. Jacob's request, Laban's response. Now verse 27, first of all, gives some good insight into the character, spiritually, of Laban. Laban said to him, "If now it pleases you, stay with me. I have divined." Now, we have no idea how he did that or what it was, but we do know if you read the Hebrew text literally, the word divined is literally consulted omens. I have consulted omens. In other words, it shows that ingrained in Laban is pagan practice. Pagan practice was to use all kinds of devices and means in order to divine what the future was and what the will of the gods were. And though we may smile at that, many an army has marched into battle in history because an emperor or a ruler looked at the wine in the glass and showed the way it shined and shimmered. And on the basis of the way the wine looked, he went into battle or he didn't go into battle. In the Old Testament, you have a reference to looking into divining by the liver. And that was to simply take a liver of an animal, cut it, and the way the lobes laid, the priest would tell you, the way the lobes in the interior looked, whether it was favorable for battle or not favorable for battle. And of course, in our age, we smile at that, but may I remind you again, many a battle has been fought and many an army has marched because of consulting omens. And so this man has simply picked up a pagan practice, what he might have done, whether it was a nephrology that he followed, like with the liver, or not, we don't know. But nonetheless, it tells something about the fact that his relationship to Jehovah is not what it should be. So I've consulted the omens that the Lord has blessed me on your account. And he continued, "Name me your wages, and I will give it." So let's note along with that response this fact, that Jacob's desire to return to the land was thwarted by the offer of wages. The desire to return. Now, later on, God is going to have to say to him, "Get up and get out of here. I want you back." And I think we can safely say when he said he wanted to go back to the land, that was God's will. God wanted him back there. That desire to return was thwarted by the offer of wages, or thwarted by a material offer. That has important principle in it. Many a desire to grow is thwarted by the material which takes its place. And this is what happens right here. We're going to talk at the end, I hope we get time to do that, about consequences. Jacob, of course, is going to buy this. If you'll help me secure material prosperity, I will stay. The irony of it is found over in chapter 31 and verse 41. He says to Laban, "These 20 years I have been in your house. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. And I don't think that means that he got a raise 10 times. This is set within the context of criticism, and I take it the change in wages were in Laban's favor. Chapter 31, going backwards in verse 7. And from verse 7 we know that it was apparently withheld wages or something of that sort, because he speaks to Jacob and Leah, and you come to verse 7 and says, "Yet your father has cheated me, changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me." So you have a kind of a double lesson there about what kind of a cheater and a liar Laban was. But it's interesting. Who was the victim of a cheater and a liar? The man who could be swayed by material things. It was a flaw that was there. Sometimes you look at some of the ridiculous, and everybody gets them. "You have been selected to pick up your prize," and so forth. And you want to say, well, you know, you see through that. Why do they keep doing it? Do you know why they keep doing it? Because it works on thousands and thousands of people. And this is a good example of that same kind of thing, is that the offer of the material was much stronger to Jacob than the possibility of returning to the land where he had promised he would go, by the way, in his vow to God. And because of that weakness, a Laban was able to come along and take advantage of him, because there are people like Jacob out there, and they're the kind of people that Laban's prey on. Okay, Jacob immediately comes back now and says, "I got a problem." Jacob's problem. And that problem is in 29 and 30. But he said to him, "You know how I've served you and how your cattle have fared with me." Notice the entire thrust of his riches is on his cattle. For a nomad's, as these men were, a nomad's wealth was his cattle. A nomad's wealth was his cattle. In other words, those were his assets. That was it. And if that was great, you are very wealthy. And that's why in the 29th verse, when he calls attention to the material wealth of Laban, he talks about his cattle. Continuing on with that, you have some colorful speech. He said, "You had little before I came, and it has increased to a multitude. And the Lord has blessed you wherever I turned." And let me just give you a literal translation there. He simply says, Yahweh has blessed me on the foot. God has blessed me upon the foot. And that is literally the way the Hebrew text reads there. And what would you think? God has blessed me on the foot. What would that mean? Well, that was an idiom for every step I take, God blesses me. God blesses me on the foot, or God blesses me with every step. stop and think about that for just a moment. And can you think of a more dramatic example in the Old Testament of blessing by grace than his blessing on this rascal? God blessed every step that Jacob took, so he says, while he was in the house of Laban. And, of course, you know, when he was in the house of Laban, he did all kinds of shady things. But nonetheless, God in grace blessed him. And this is a good example of blessing by grace. Notice that Laban is aware that it's not just his skill. With cattle that made Jacob successful, it was the blessing of God. Well, with that, verse 31, Jacob makes his inquiry. He says, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob says, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this one thing," and here's his plan, "I will again pasture and keep your flock. Let me pass through your entire flock today, removing from there every speckled and spotted sheep and every black one among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and such shall be my wages. So my honesty will answer for me later. When you come concerning my wages, every one that is not speckled, spotted among the goats, and black among the lambs, if found with me, will be considered stolen." So he simply says that he's willing to take the speckled cattle and so forth. The plan that Jacob suggests is really going to put the possibility of gaining wealth entirely on the hands of God. Two things we know about sheep in the Orient. One, we know that sheep are normally white. And we also know that goats are normally black. And we also know that the exception to it would be very, very rare. So, and notice how Jacob precludes the possibility of deceiving. "If you find any of these black or whites with my flock, then you can take them." Jacob's plan was very, very risky. How could, if he separated out the speckled ones, how could unicolored animals produce speckled animals? So it's a risky plan. Laban, therefore, verse 34, agrees to it. Laban said, "Good, let it be according to your word." Now, that's the narrative. Everything's all set up. And now we're ready to go with the results of the agreement. Number one was the making of the agreement, and now the results of the agreement. Verses 35-43. And we'll have the opposition first, and then the success. First, the opposition of a deceptive competitor, verses 35 and 36. Immediately upon the agreement, Laban runs out the door, I'm sure, and he does three things. The first thing which he does is to go to the sheep and separates all of the speckled ones. Second, he sets his sons guard over them. Protectors or guards over them. And he says, "Guys, take the sheep and split." And the third thing he does, sends them on a 3-day journey with all the speckled sheep. Now what that's like, then, is Jacob looking in the refrigerator, and there are, let's say, 2 dozen prime steaks and 3 packs of bologna. And he saw them. They were there. And the agreement is made that, what are my wages? I'll take the 3 packs of bologna. And the other person representing Laban would say, "Fine." And before you can get your bologna, and when you arrive at the refrigerator, the bologna's gone. It's been carried 3 days' journey away. And that's the character of Laban and what he does to Jacob in this context. Now, with that arrangement, we need to fill in some background. There were two things that in our age, scientific age, seem absurd to us, but they were true. There was ancient superstition that the offspring were influenced by the experiences of their mother during pregnancy. The other viewpoint was that if there was something seen very vividly during conception, it would leave its mark on the embryo. And let me read from an excellent statement of, in my opinion, and I believe I'm right, when you come down to verse 37, Jacob resorted to superstition. I do not believe it worked. The text doesn't say it worked. It just says he did it. And therefore, to a Western reader, you have some strange reading. The essence of it is that the conception and the embryo could be influenced by experience or by sight. So verse 37, Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees, peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. His thinking is that as the sheep come to water, this vivid scene will affect their conception and affect the embryo. And he set the rods, verse 38, which he had peeled in front of the flocks and the gutters, even in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink. And they mated when they came to drink. So the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth stripes, speckled and spotted. Now notice something in the context. It does not say this worked. It doesn't say that what he did was the cause. It just says this is what he did. And so forth down through to verse 43. Let me read a statement by Marsh out of a very excellent study called Studies in Creationism. He says, all the marking of the offspring, such as that which Jacob thought he was accomplishing in Laban's flocks, is completely impossible. In the placenta and the umbilical cord, which constitute the only connection between the mother and the fetus, there are no nerves. Thus, absolutely no mechanism exists whereby the mother can mark her offspring the way that Jacob thought he was accomplishing the marking. And therefore, let's close out with some observations here on this event. Number one, the account says what Jacob did. It does not say it was effective. The account records what Jacob did. But does not attribute success to what he did. And try reading through here. And we have a mind that very often links cause and effect together. And that can be very, very misleading. I think it told you the strange direction that so-called reasoning can take about the man that had the frog, and the frog could jump, and he pulled one leg off the frog and said, jump, frog, and the frog jumped with three legs. He then noted in his notebook, a frog can jump with three legs. He then pulled off another leg. And when he pulled off the other leg, he said, jump, frog. And the frog jumped. And he noted that a frog can jump with two legs, not as far, but he can still jump with two legs. He then pulled off a third leg, leaving only one, said, jump, frog. And it wasn't a very good jump, but he did note that a frog can jump with only one leg. He then pulled off the fourth leg and said, jump, frog, and nothing happened. And he recorded, when you pull all the legs off of a frog, they lose their hearing. So you see, that's the illogical conclusion you can come to if you let your mind go in that direction. And we tend, always in fact, in your thinking, it's always good to remember that we tend to link cause and effect. I suppose sometime someone walked under a ladder and hit a banana peel and fell, and I suppose the superstition about walking under ladders developed because someone made a cause and effect link. In fact, most superstition is erroneous cause and effect thinking. And since we tend to think in terms of cause and effect, let's read through these verses and notice it only says what he did, and it does not attribute success to it. It just says, this is what he did. Now, there may have been some kind of clever breeding involved here. I don't know. But notice you can't necessarily associate a cause and effect with this. Verse 37. Jacob took fresh rods of poplar and almond and plane trees, peeled white stripes in them, exposing the white which was in the rods. And he set the rods which he had peeled in front of the flocks in the gutters, even in the watering troughs, where the flocks came to drink, and they mated when they came to drink. Who is to say that they wouldn't have mated without those? And the answer is no one can say they would. You can establish that part of the thinking was with a vivid object they would be more likely to. Whether or not that's true or not is not the point. So, verse 39, the flocks mated by the rods, and the flocks brought forth stripes, speckled and spotted. Jacob separated the lambs, made the flocks face toward the striped and all the black in the flock of Laban. He put his own herds apart, did not put them with Laban's flock. Did that do any good? I don't know. Jacob apparently thought it did, but the text doesn't say it did. Moreover, verse 41, it came about whenever the stronger the flock were mating that Jacob would place the rods in the side of the flock in the gutters that so they might mate by the rods. But when the flock was feeble, he did not put them in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. So the man became exceeding prosperous. And so does not imply that the foregoing was the cause of the prosperity. That would only be put in there if we want to imagine so and if we use wrong cause and effect reasoning. Suppose he had fed the lambs, and you could have written a narrative back here, that he fed them peanut butter and jelly. So the man became exceedingly prosperous. Doesn't mean that because you gave the lambs peanut butter and jelly sandwiches that that's why they multiplied. So this is simply a circumstance probably reflecting superstition, but we can also add to that one other thing, that there was a supernatural element involved in it, and we get that from chapter 31. Verse 9. And let's put down this on a positive note, and it is going to be this. The reason for the multiplication of the flocks is stated in 31:9-13. The reason is found in 31:9-13, not in the actions of Jacob or in the actions of superstition. Chapter 31 and verse 9 reads, thus God has taken away your father's livestock and given them to me. Now note this, it came about at the time when the flock were mating, that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. And the angel of God came to me in the dream and said, Jacob, and he said, here am I. And he said, lift up now your eyes and see all that the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. And what is the implication? The implication is, Jacob, whatever this thing is you're trying to pull off, I want you to understand something. That the reason you're getting the speckled and spotted lambs and cattle is not because of what you're practicing, but I want you to know something. I'm looking down on what Laban had done to you, and I am providing them supernaturally. And when you see it from that perspective, then you don't have to go back into this earlier part of the chapter and try to justify the suspicion. It's simply he is picking up on a custom of the day, and that's in essence all that there really is to it. Okay. Now let's go to a third set of observations, and it is this. This is truly, in this section of Genesis, a study in consequences. The study in consequences is found, and you can find it only in the Hebrew text, of the book of Proverbs. And if you go to Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 4, let's list some of them. Now let's first of all ask this. Why do most people, I think it's fair to say, act without consideration of consequences? As a matter of fact, who's sitting here tonight hasn't acted rashly? Didn't consider the consequences, and you've had to live with the consequences. You wish you didn't, but you just didn't think of consequences at the time. Why do people tend to overlook consequences? Very simple answer to that. Sin never advertises its results. Sin never advertises its results. And with chapter 5, Solomon picks up with that theme down in verse 4. And it's found in the words, but in the end. The simplest translation for the Hebrew expression would be afterwards. Translated here, in the end. And since everyone I'm going to call your attention to is going to be the same Hebrew expression translated differently in the English, let's just make all of these one translation so we'll be consistent with the original and use the word afterwards. So, chapter 5 and verse 4. Afterwards, she is bitter as wormwood. And what we'll want to look at is what is the before and what is the afterwards. Well, the chapter begins by saying, my son, give attention to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding that you may observe discretion. Your lips may reserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil her speech. Afterwards, she is bitter as wormwood. Notice the honey of verse 3 becomes the wormwood of verse 4, and the sweetness of verse 3 becomes the bitterness of verse 4. And what's the difference? The link is consequences. So, we have here the afterwards of adultery. 5:4. Proverbs 14:12. This one is mentioned two times in the book. It's in 14:12 and in 16:25. 14:12. Common verse you've heard over and over. There is a way or a road or a path, often it's used for course of life, which seems right to a man. And notice, by the way, which seems is in italics. So it's, there is a path right to man, but its end, same expression, afterwards, it is the road to death. And so, this is the afterward of following human viewpoint. The afterwards of following human viewpoint. 14:12, and you have an identical passage also in chapter 16, verse 25. Solomon also notices that there is an afterwards of careless fun. How many lives are taken when we were just having a ball until the car hit the tree? And you were having a good time, but the afterwards of that fun was tragedy. And this is found, for example, in Proverbs 14:13, just the next verse. Even in laughter, the heart may be in pain, and the afterwards of joy, probably taken here in a frivolous sense, true joy would not end with grief, so it's apparently it's careless fun kind of joy. The afterwards of careless fun may be grief. It can all come down so very, very quickly. Consider consequences. 4. And this is pertinent for what we're looking at. The afterwards of dishonest gain. Proverbs 20:21. Now, there's strong implication in the way the original reads here that the idea of the gain is not just hurriedly, but it's also in a not quite honest way. So verse 21, an inheritance gained hurriedly, parenthesis, in a dishonest way at the beginning, will not be blessed afterwards. Chapter 25, verse 8. We all know this one. The afterwards and the consequences of hasty words. 25:8. Do not go out hastily to argue your case. It's saying, think before you open your mouth. Otherwise, what will you do afterward? And the implication is what you've spoken was hasty, and now it's been said, what are you going to do afterwards? Now, fortunately, there are two things that Proverbs speaks about that are good consequences. There can be good ones as well as bad ones, and let's look at two of the afterwards. Proverbs 23:18. Saying, surely there is a future. The word future translates the word that means afterwards. Surely there is an afterwards. And your hope will not be cut off. And this is an emphasis, is not to give up hope, the importance of hope and in maintaining hope. If we respond properly to discipline, it has a good afterwards. Chapter 19 and verse 20. says, listen to counsel, accept discipline, that you may be wise the rest of your days, that you may be wise, and it's the expression again, afterwards. So we've had it translated what? Future, the rest of, or in the end. It's all the same Hebrew expression, afterwards. That you may be wise afterwards. In other words, the afterwards is wisdom. And it comes from the willingness to listen to counsel, and of course for Proverbs that would be listening to the Word, the truth, and accepting God's discipline in a right way, which will develop wisdom. Father, we're thankful once again for the book of Genesis and for your truth and your Word. We pray that as we look at this narrative of the consequences of a man who deceived and then was deceived by another and then deceived that other, may we recognize that these are all consequences of decisions and actions and moves that were made on the part of Jacob. And we pray that we might recognize that the Holy Spirit has purposely put this in front of us so we also can give serious thought to to the doctrine of consequences. In Christ's name.